I'm guessing you're here joining me on my podcast because true crime is your thing. And if true crime is your thing, then you've definitely heard about the case of Gypsy Rose Blanchard. If you didn't at the time of the crime, then I'm pretty sure you will have by now, as she has just been released from prison. Her recent release has sparked a new conversation regarding how people, but mainly children, who suffer through long-term abuse retaliate against the person inflicting that abuse. Gypsy's case has captured insane media attention, not only because of the crime committed, but also because of the abuse leading up to it. Now, no one is arguing that 100% Gypsy was a victim. But recently, I've noticed that with her own TikToks, her countless interviews and brand deals, it's almost glamorising what she did. And certain parts of the internet have started casting a bit more of a critical eye on her decision to kill her abusive mum, instead of reaching out to authorities. Gypsy's case definitely stands out as one of the well-known cases of medical child abuse that ended in murder. But her story is not unique. Long before Gypsy was even born, there were children who resorted to the unthinkable in order to finally reclaim their life from their abusers. And in today's episode, we're going to visit three of those such cases. Hey Coffee and Crimers, I'm your host, Belle Fagan. Linda Sue Glacier was put into foster care when she was 4 and adopted by William and Dorothy Glacier when she was 7. The Glaciers lived in a rural part of Maryland, meaning that little Linda didn't have any neighbourhood kids that she could play with, so she ended up spending most of her time alone. The family, though, was pretty comfortable financially and would often take trips to California and Florida. But as Linda grew up, William began using physical punishment when she'd misbehave. The abuse escalated, and it wasn't long before Linda was enduring severe beatings and cruel treatment. When she was 12, Dorothy was admitted to the hospital, leaving Linda alone with William. An argument over her not eating dinner turned into a savage beating, followed by a rape. Dorothy found out about the sexual abuse, and this is the crazy part. She was angry, but not with William. She was mad at Linda, and accused her of trying to steal her husband. Linda ran away at least twice, once to a neighbour's house where she begged them to call the police. They did, and she told her story to the authorities, even going as far as talking to the district attorney. She was referred to the Maryland Children's Centre for an evaluation, where again she told doctors about the physical and sexual abuse that she was enduring at home. But at every turn, she was dismissed. And shockingly, she was eventually sent back to the Glacier home. I can't even imagine what going back must have been like for her. Linda turned 17 and was beyond desperate to get out of the house when she met a 23-year-old electrician called James Greenwell, known as Dickie by his friends and family. William did not approve of this relationship, and he made no effort to hide his dislike of James. The two would often argue, and at one point, William even threatened to kill him. James took the threat seriously, and the next time he went to pick Linda up, he brought a shotgun with him. And that's when everything came to a head. On September 20th, 1974, James was at Linda's waiting for her to finish getting ready so that they could go out for the night. As Linda was saying goodnight to her parents in their bedroom, William grabbed her breasts and tried to pull her down for a kiss. Ugh. Hearing Linda's cries, James ran and got the shotgun and shot both William and Dorothy in their beds. 3 days later, on September 23rd, Raymond Davis, the Glacier's neighbour, heard their dog non-stop barking early in the morning. By 7 a.m, Raymond was getting annoyed and also a little concerned, so went over to see what was going on. He noticed that William's car was not on the drive, and when he looked through a window, he saw a complete mess. Drawers had been pulled out, cabinets open, items just literally all over the floor. Going into the house, he clocked all the damage, and then went looking to see if anyone was home. When he got to the master bedroom, he found William and Dorothy's bodies and immediately called the police. Investigators called the college Linda had been attending, but she wasn't there. A few hours later, though, she called the sheriff's office. Speaking to Sheriff Johnson, she said, quote, "This is Linda Sue Glazier, and I want to know what the hell is going on down at my mother and father's." Asking where she was, she told him that she was at James's trailer, followed again by, "I demand to know what the hell is going on at my mother and father's." Sheriff Johnson told her to stay where she was and that he would send a deputy over to explain to her what had happened because there had been an accident. The deputy brought both Linda and James back to the station for questioning, and their story quickly poured out. Both of them say that Linda had been in another room during the shooting, but the police didn't buy it. And the two of them were charged with murder and robbery based on the state of the home and where the bodies were discovered. Linda admitted that she'd talked to James about the abuse that she was suffering at home, but denied ever having discussed murdering her parents. In an affidavit, she wrote, "I probably told him that I wish they were dead, but we did not ever discuss killing them." But then, super randomly, she told them that James was mentally unstable to the point where he believed he was possessed by the devil. Now, I don't know if it was potentially to give him a reason for killing them or if it was actually true. During the trial, no information about the abuse in the Glazier home was allowed to be admitted as evidence, which is just crazy, because there were actually records proving the abuse back from when she'd been referred to the Maryland Children's Centre. Both James and Linda were tried separately, and they both received 2 consecutive life sentences for the crime. Linda, though, was granted a petition for clemency based on the physical and sexual abuse. While in jail, Linda's lawyers filed multiple appeals, and she was eventually granted a petition for clemency based on the physical and sexual abuse. Her lawyers argued that if she had been tried today, yes, she still would have served time, but not life. And she wouldn't have automatically been disbelieved. Instead, she would have been able to tell her whole story. So like I said, that petition was actually successful, and Linda was released in 1995 after serving just under 20 years. James still remains in prison today. Our second case takes place in February of 1986. Cheryl Pearson was a 16-year-old high school student who walked out of her family home to find her dad laying face down in the driveway. Within a week, Cheryl and 2 others would be behind bars for the crime. Cheryl's dad, James Pearson, was known for being a bit of a rough and abrupt kind of guy, but also a generally friendly one. Family and friends agree that they never saw any child abuse, but they did say that James was a strict parent who expected regimented behaviour from each of his 3 children. He had trained his kids to fall silent any time an adult walked into a room and would threaten them with a spanking if or when they got out of line. I mean, it's definitely giving a Victorian vibe of children should be seen and not heard. But on the flip side, he was also known for showering his kids with gifts and constantly looking for ways that he could earn some extra money to support his family. Cheryl's mum, Kathleen, became ill in 1979 with a rare and terminal kidney disease. And almost overnight, the Pearson family hierarchy changed. Kathleen was in and out of hospital due to her need for dialysis. This left Cheryl, only 10 at the time, as the woman of the house, as it were. Cheryl suddenly was in charge of most of the household chores, including caring for her baby sister. During the time that Kathleen was in hospital for extended periods, James started paying a lot more attention to Cheryl. And at first, she loved the extra attention. In fact, she was quoted as saying, "When my mother got sick, I felt no one was paying attention to me. Then my father started paying attention to me. At first, I was really happy, because until then, I didn't think he knew I existed." End quote. And it was during that time that, according to Cheryl, her dad began to sexually abuse her. Although she knew her dad's sexual advances were wrong, she kind of felt like she had no choice but to go along with whatever he wanted. She was scared of what he would do or what would happen if she refused. And she also didn't feel like she could tell her mum, considering how sick she was. So she kept quiet and their sexual relationship continued. When Kathleen died on February 13th, 1985, the family was beyond devastated. James told friends that he was so conflicted. One minute he was in the depths of grief over losing his wife, and then the next he said he felt angry, like she'd abandoned him with the kids. By the time Cheryl was 15, she was a cheerleader and had started dating a boy called Robert Cuccio. Initially, James had refused to allow the two of them to be alone, and he would chaperone them on their dates. Now, if that's not orcs, I don't know what is. But after a while, however, he chilled out and just gave Cheryl a curfew instead. What didn't chill out, shall we say, is the abuse. And eventually Cheryl confided in Robert. He was the only person she ever felt she could tell about the abuse. As their relationship grew, the two spent more and more time away from the house. But that meant that Cheryl started worrying about the safety of her little sister. She would come home to find her sister and her dad cozied up under the covers or playfully roughhousing, and would get the most sick feeling of deja vu, as this was exactly how it had begun with her. Being gone more often was now leaving her sister at risk. In November 1985, as Cheryl walked into school, she overheard a group of other kids talking about the news of a murder for hire that had happened in the next town. According to the news report, a woman had hired a hitman to kill her husband, who she claimed was abusing her. Cheryl was shocked and told her friend and classmate, Sean Pika. She said to Sean, "Who would be crazy enough to do that?" And his reply, "Well, I'd kill someone if the money was right." And here is where the plan begins. Asking him how much money, he said $1,000. She told him to hold that thought, and a couple of days later, she went back to him and told him that she wanted to make a deal. Cheryl never told Sean why she wanted her dad murdered, and he never asked. What made this even more bizarre was that to all intents and purposes, Sean was actually a pretty good kid. He was working towards becoming an Eagle Scout, he had a steady girlfriend, and was actually about to represent his high school at a carpentry competition. So he's not exactly the kind of kid you'd peg as a wannabe hitman. A week later, during a class together, Sean leaned over to Cheryl and told her that he'd take the job. No money was exchanged at that point, but Cheryl said, "Go for it." Over the winter, Sean told Cheryl that he'd made an attempt, but it had failed. He told her that he'd thrown a rock through the window of an empty rental house that James Pearson owned. Sean was hoping that the alarm would go off and it would bring James to the house, where Sean would be waiting with a shotgun. But no alarm went off, so Sean just went home. But on the morning of February 5th, 1986, Sean found his moment. Hiding behind a tree on the Pearson property and holding a .22 rifle, he sat watching the house. And when James stepped out onto the driveway, Sean took aim and fired 5 shots, hitting James in the head and the chest. Cheryl then got Robert to deliver a payment of $400 to Sean the next day, while she organised the funeral arrangements for her dad. At the funeral, family and friends said Cheryl seemed devastated like anyone would, even bending down to kiss her dad's coffin. Sean, though, was not happy with only $400. He asked Cheryl to give him a motorcycle, more money, and permission to live in the rental house, the one that he'd thrown the brick into the window. Cheryl said no to all of those demands and left it at that. It was done and dusted as far as she was concerned. Except, before long, the local police got an anonymous tip that Cheryl had been looking for a hitman to kill her dad. The police began questioning her, and Cheryl almost immediately folded. Cheryl, Robert, and Sean were all charged with various crimes relating to the murder of James Pearson. Sean was sentenced to 24 years for manslaughter, but served 18. And today he runs a program helping former inmates. Cheryl served only 3 months for manslaughter. Robert pled guilty to criminal solicitation and was given probation. And Cheryl and Robert actually got married after her release, and they both wrote a book about their experience called Incest, Murder and a Miracle. A victim, yes, but a justified murder? You tell me. Our final case brings us to the 90s, in the town of Rush Spring, Oklahoma, with a population of only 1,200. To say it was a town where everyone knew everyone's business was the understatement of the century, meaning that everyone knew exactly what was happening in the home of Herman and Drewy Dutton when the unthinkable happened. The Dutton home was built on routine. Their tiny mobile home ran like clockwork, with their dad Lonnie playing the role of watchman. He'd wash down handfuls of sedatives with his homebrew beer, and then he'd kick the crap out of his kids with his steel-toed boots. He'd send the older boys out to shoplift whatever they could, and whoever came back with the least got beaten even harder. And sometimes, just for fun, he'd get them to throw darts at their younger sister. Oh my goodness, yeah, so fun. But then at the same time, he'd also tell his sons to protect their younger sister by any means necessary. He'd get right in their faces and scream, "If anyone messes with Sissy, shoot them behind the ear or in the heart. Kill them." And it would be this exact order that would be his own undoing. Lonnie was well known for being a mean drunk and a bully. His cousin told reporters that Lonnie was a belligerent, obnoxious, spiteful person whose only goal seemed to be how many people he could make hate and fear him. On July 12, 1993, the temperature outside was hot. The boys were working in the garden while Lonnie slept on the couch inside their trailer. Their sister, Alicia, who their dad called Sissy, slipped outside and quietly said to her brothers, quote, "Daddy was messing with me." The two brothers looked at each other and walked inside. They loaded a rifle that Lonnie had given to Herman for Christmas. Herman took the rifle, put it to his shoulder and aimed at his dad's ear. Drewy then leaned over, held his breath and pulled the trigger. The shot rang out through the tiny town of Rush Springs on that sweltering afternoon when most people were outdoors. Wayne Munn, the Dutton children's older cousin, had often tried to get the kids out of the house and away from Lonnie as much as he could. And that afternoon, he decided that he was going to go over and take the kids fishing. As he pulled into the road leading up to the trailer, he saw the family's pickup truck coming down the dirt road with all four kids huddled in the front seat and Herman at the wheel. All the kids were crying, and Herman immediately said to Wayne, "I think I just killed Daddy." Wayne had expected the boys to, I don't know, tell him that there'd been an accident or maybe a fight that had gone too far. But as the boys told him what happened, he quickly realised that this was no accident. The boys repeated the exact same story to the local police, never denying anything about the shooting. And like I said, Lonnie was well known not only to the police, but to the town in general. He was a mean guy and even meaner when he was drunk or high, which, to be honest, was pretty much always. As the word spread, the town came together and rallied around the boys. An empty bar was used as a kind of, like, headquarters for the Save Herman and Drewy cause, and locals who knew the boys were quick to talk to various reporters, and the story grew, gaining national and international attention. Their school friends and their teachers described the boys as shy and polite. And one teacher even sat down for an interview with NBC and said, "Although we don't condone murder, we do support our kids." Blue ribbons were placed all over the town in support of the boys, with stores actually painting their windows with the words, "Friends of Herman and Drewy, we support you." Both the boys were charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. And they pleaded no contest to first-degree manslaughter. And the district attorney agreed to drop the charges when Herman turned 18, as long as the boys stayed out of trouble. Their sentence was officially put off in 1996, and the boys went to live with their grandparents, who had spent those last few years working with Child Protective Services and state therapists to make a good home for the boys. The two Dutton girls moved in with an aunt, and to this day, both boys continue to live in the same area. All of these parents met with the same fate, but their children all received various punishments. Gypsy Rose Blanchard was released early after serving 8 years for the brutal murder of her mum. So the question is, should any of these children have been convicted? Now, it's definitely a controversial moral and legal dilemma, because most times these cases are tried as parricide, which just means the murder of parents. And most of these kids try to use self-defence, and that is rejected, because the legal definition of self-defence is that you are confronted by an immediate and obvious threat to your life. Whereas most times, these murders often happen when the parent is in a vulnerable position. For example, sleeping, like we saw with the Dutton brothers who killed their dad Lonnie, and also in Gypsy Rose Blanchard's case, her mum was sleeping in bed. But it does pose a moral dilemma, in my opinion, because an abused child's perception of threat is different. But then again, that opens a whole can of worms, allowing children who kill their parents simply because they're annoyed with them start trying to use the lie of abuse as a cover. Like there was a case not long ago about a kid who killed his mum because she wouldn't let him order a VR set. So could he then try and make out that she'd been abusing him just to get away with it? Or even if the abuse is true, that murder then becomes totally okay and an allowable option to every kid. Like I said, it is a super tricky one, and sadly, I don't think that parricide or self-defense is going to be going away anytime soon. To see today's case photos, click on the link in the case description to join the Cup of Coffee and Crime Facebook discussion group. And also linked in the description is my TikTok page, where you will find different cases being discussed weekly over there too. Until next week, stay safe.